Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. I hope you find this session useful. Just a quick introduction. My name is David Litchfield. I'm the Managing Director of NGS Software in the United Kingdom. And today I'm going to be speaking about Oracle PLSQL injection. So, first off, we need to understand what PLSQL is. It's Oracle's extension to SQL, essentially. It's programmable. Very much like TSQL, Transact SQL, on Microsoft SQL Server. It can be used to create stored procedures, functions, packages, which are essentially collections of procedures and functions, triggers, database triggers, and objects. Functionality of the database server can be extended with external procedures. PLSQL can call out to dynamic link libraries or shared objects. When a PLSQL procedure is created, you can specify an auth ID current user keyword. If that has been specified, when the object has been created, the object being the procedure, the function, whatever, if the auth ID current user keyword has been specified, it executes, the procedure will execute with the privileges of the person invoking the procedure. If the auth ID current user keyword is not specified, the procedure will execute with the permissions of the person who defined the privilege, the procedure. Now that's important. By default, the auth ID current user keyword is not specified. So any procedure will basically act like a set UID binary on a Linux or Solaris system. It executes with greater privileges. So if I'm a low-privileged user in a database server, say Scott, for example, and I execute a procedure which has been defined by Sys, Sys being the most powerful user in an Oracle database server, if I, as Scott, execute a procedure owned by Sys, and that procedure has not used the auth ID current user keyword, then that procedure will execute with the permissions of Sys. Needless to say, if there are any vulnerabilities within that procedure, and I exploit those, I exploit that vulnerability, I can gain Sys privileges. PLSQL can be executed over the web through Oracle Application Server. The web portal aspect of Oracle Application Server essentially acts as a proxy. So when I, as a web client, request a PLSQL procedure through an application server, the application server essentially just passes that request on to the database server. That is then executed in the back end. So if I can find a procedure which is vulnerable to, say, PLSQL injection, or a buffer overflow for that matter, if I can find a procedure which is vulnerable in some way, I can affect an attack over the web through Oracle Application Server and gain control of the back-end database server. So, if we look at PLSQL injection, which is the subject of this talk, assume we have various kinds of procedures. Some will do select statements. Some may do some kind of DML operation, data manipulation language, i.e. update, delete, or insert. Some stored procedures actually execute anonymous PLSQL blocks. Now, an anonymous PLSQL block is basically, if I was to sit in front of SQL Plus, which is the client used to connect to the database server, I can say, declare this variable execute this, do that for me, and so on. That's known as an anonymous PLSQL block. Now, it's quite common, very common in fact, to come across procedures that actually execute anonymous PLSQL blocks within the procedure itself. So we'll look at a couple of these. So here is an example procedure which is vulnerable to SQL injection via select. I don't have a laser pointer with me, unfortunately, which I don't. But essentially, what we're doing here with this procedure is taking user input, powner, in the top right-hand corner. That input is then passed into a query. Select object name from all objects where owner equals user-supplied input and object type equals library. Essentially, this procedure just lists libraries owned by a given user. Now, if this was defined by sys, because it's vulnerable to PLSQL injection, a low-privileged user can inject into the pwner. Before we get there, if we were to execute this normally, we would do exec sys dot list libraries bracket single quote whoever we're looking for single quote bracket semicolon. That's how it should be executed normally. If, however, we enter as our user supplied input foo single quote union select password from sys users minus minus at the end, we'll get a list of libraries owned by foo, if there is indeed such a user. But not only that, we'll get a list of passwords from the users table as well. Now, the reason this is working, essentially, is because of this single quote, the double single quote there. The query becomes select object name from all objects where owner equals single quote foo single quote union select password from sys users minus minus. Cutting off, the minus minus acts as a comment delimiter and cuts off the and object type equals library. Now this is easy to do. It's easy to get data back if the information is printed back to the screen. If it's not printed back to the screen, then what can we do? So, for example, we have another PLSQL object. This time it's a function. Essentially, we take user input, pwner again, and that's stuck in a query, select count, from all objects where owner equals pwner. Now this essentially lists the number of objects owned by a given user. So there's no information other than the fact that user Scott owns 5,000 objects. So if we were to look at exploiting this, we try the usual double quote, you know, the quote, quote, union select. But we have an error returned. The expression must have the same data type as the corresponding expression. So that doesn't work. If we try even return numerical data, because the count function returns numerical data, if we even try and return that, we get a problem. Exact fetch returns more than the requested number of rows. This, here we're selecting the user number from the users table. We're still getting errors. If we try doing a subselect, that doesn't do us any favors either. We just get zero returned, essentially. So, is that exploitable? The reason we have to look at why something or is something exploitable is because too many developers out there turn around and say, well, that can't be exploited because it only returns, you know, one row of numerical data. So you tell me how you're going to get the passwords back. Well, when you come across against people like that, and in my job, I often do come across people like that who will not believe you until it's proved to you. You have to go away working out how it can be exploited and then demonstrate to them. Well, one way, one simple way, is through the attacker creating their own function that does the job for them. So we inject this function into the vulnerable procedure or function. So if we look at this function here, it's create or replace function, get it, that's the name of it, returning type data of varchar2, but interestingly, we specify the authID current user keyword. So what happens is, when we inject this function into the vulnerable procedure, or function for that matter, because the vulnerable function is executing with definer rights, i.e. it's executing with sys, or system privileges, and we specify authID current user in our function, well, that then means our function will execute with sys privileges, and not our privileges as the definer. So essentially, the body of our function will select the password from every account. Well, actually, in this case, it's select the password from the users table where the name of the account we're interested in is sys. We inject this function in, and we then do a DBMS output put line. That basically prints things to the screen for us. We print that information back out. So even though the initial function didn't print anything useful to the screen to us as far as a union injection was concerned, by injecting our own attacker-defined function, we can do whatever we want, within reason. Thank you. Great. So as we can see, we inject, this is the vulnerable function, select account. We inject here the name of our procedure, scott.getit. I'm assuming we're Scott, of course. We execute that, and we say, well, where's our output? Nothing at this moment in time is printed to screen. So if we then call exec DBMS output put line something or other, the data is actually returned. It's a buffering problem with DBMS output. Now, there are certain limitations with this. We can't, and this is wrong, by the way. I only found out last night it's wrong, so I haven't had time to update my slides. I thought you couldn't execute DML or DDL statements if you're injecting into a select statement. Now, I will come back to what you can do. Well, let me explain this further. Select is not DML. If there is a function, a function or procedure, which does an insert, an update, or delete, that's DML. So I'm just trying to find an example. Okay. So here's an example of a vulnerable procedure. Basically, we take user input, we insert that user input here. That's where the injection vector is, just here. Now, we are inserting data into the employees table. Because it's the vulnerable procedure is doing a DML operation itself, it allows us to do other DML operations within the injection. So we can do an insert, an inject, delete, or an update. Now, previously, I thought we couldn't do DML or DDL operations within injecting into a select statement. What I found out last night by playing around was that by specifying a pragma autonomous transaction, we can do absolutely anything we want. So, if we have, go back to our one of our inject into a select statement. Here we have a select count again from all objects where owner is powner. If we inject a function in here, but when we create that function, if we specify the autonomous transaction pragma, then basically what that says to Oracle is, this can execute, no problems, there's not going to be any problems with rollback issues or anything like that, so just go ahead and just execute it. So we can, in fact, if we have a vulnerable select statement, we can inject an insert, we can inject an update, we can inject a delete. What's more, we can insert DDL as well. For example, we can say grant DBA to public. So through a SQL PL/SQL injection vulnerability that goes into a select statement, we can pretty much do anything we want as sys by specifying the autonomous transaction pragma. And as I said, I found this last night, so unfortunately I haven't been able to update my slides. So this limitations is wrong. We can't execute DML or DDL is wrong. We can do so. So, continuing on anyway, here we have an insert statement which we can inject into. Again, the reason being is because of these double pipes, basically. This double pipe is basically a concatenation operator. So it basically says, take whatever is in here, concatenate it into this string here, and then execute that statement. Because we're supplying our own additional single quotes, the query is basically modified to that of the attacker's choosing. So as an example here, what we're going to do is set the password for the anonymous user to this. Now, the Oracle password algorithm basically uses this as a salt and uses a bastardized version of triple DES to come up with the password. So this password is this, if uppercase anonymous. And on every single Oracle database server, providing it at the right version, of course, version 9 started using triple DES. Before that, it was one round of DES. Then we can basically guarantee that's going to decrypt. Well, not decrypt. That's the hash for anonymous. So when we execute that, we basically reset the password for anonymous, which can be used as a backdoor. Again, this limitation is wrong. We can execute DDL. So, for example, we could create a table. Injecting into anonymous PL/SQL blocks. We have full control, but we have full control anyway. We can inject select statements, insert, update, deletes, and DDL, create drops, grant DBA, and so on. We can basically write a whole script of our own PL/SQL and stick it in if we can inject into an anonymous PL/SQL block. So as an example, we have a procedure here called anon block which executes this statement. The statement being begin, DBMS output, put line, user supplied input, end the anonymous PL/SQL block, then execute it. And we inject into the pbuf and do whatever we want essentially in there. Now there are real world examples of these. I'm sure some of you will remember at the beginning of September, Oracle released a massive patch for a number of issues discovered by a number of security researchers. Within there, they patched about 35 PL/SQL injection issues, the details of which we've essentially embargoed to give administrators, DBAs, enough time to patch before releasing the details. So on December the 1st, we have a three-month embargo period, basically. You will see some real-world examples as supplied with Oracle where there are procedures where we can inject into PL/SQL anonymous blocks, where we can inject into select statements, where we can inject into DNL kind of operations. And there are loads of them. And I spent a day looking for them, and as I said, found 35 of them. Triggers are often used as a mechanism to help protect the integrity of your data. They're often used as security mechanisms to ensure that people shouldn't be doing things. Triggers can be abused. They are vulnerable to PL/SQL injection. Now, there are a number of triggers that are installed with Oracle by default that are vulnerable to PL/SQL injection. They take the old data, compare it with the new data, and verify that it's of a certain form, and then put it into a SQL query. Now, by modifying the new and the old data in certain ways, we can effectively insert code into database triggers and gain elevated database privileges by a PL/SQL injection. There is another trigger owned by MDSys. There are two triggers, actually, owned by the MDSys user, which is a DBA. It's equivalent in terms of privileges to Sys. Sys obviously being the most powerful user. Now, what Sys does, what these triggers do, essentially, is extract the name of a function from a table and then executes that function. Now, by default, only MDSys can update the table that stores the name of these functions. However, there's a stored procedure that allows us to insert into that as MDSys. So a low-privileged user like Scott can come along. Actually, give us a sec, because this is quite a convoluted one. Sorry, bear with me. I'm just going to increase the size. Is that readable? Okay. So, this trigger basically fires when a delete operation is performed on the SDO TXN IDX inserts table, which is also owned by MDSys. This isn't the one. I'll tell you what. I'll just ignore that. I'll just talk over it. Essentially, there are two procedures that allow us to insert into this table that contains a list of functions that are to be executed by the trigger when an operation is performed on a given table. So by creating our own function, then supplying this function name to the MDSys procedure, we can get our function name into this MDSys table. We then perform an insert operation on the table the trigger is defined for. So the trigger then goes out, gets the name of our function from the other table, and executes that function with the privileges of MDSys, because the trigger is executing with the privileges of the definer. There is no way to specify the auth ID current key, the auth ID current user keyword within triggers. So all triggers execute with the privileges of the definer. So if it's vulnerable in some form or fashion, we can gain elevated database privileges. Now, people who are responsible out there for developing PLSQL applications never use, unless you're absolutely 100% sure it's safe to do so, never use the concatenation operator, i.e. the double pipes. Certainly they should not be going anywhere near a SQL query. In these cases, you should be using bind variables or host variables. Bind variables essentially say, here is my SQL query with some placeholders. Build the query tree, get all that nice and ready, and then, once that's done, insert the data. And then fire it off. Execute that query. By using bind variables, we can protect against PLSQL injection. Added to the fact, it's faster, it's quicker, you get better performance. The other way, of course, to protect against PLSQL injection is to validate user input. If you're not validating input, then you are asking for trouble. So, I've tried to give a quick overview of the dangers of PLSQL injection. So, are there any questions about this? Any questions? Thanks, mate. Yeah, sure. Yes. Give us 2 seconds. Give us, I'm just going to bring out one of my Okay. Sorry. Here's an example that's got, interestingly, both in them. So we have here a statement that one here is using concatenation. So K table is placed in here. And yet they're using a bind variable RID here. So when we do the execute immediate, it's using this for this bind variable. So here we have an example of doing it right at one on one hand and doing it wrong on the other hand. If the user can manipulate K table, then they can inject into this. If, however, they set this to colon table and change this to into ret using L underscore table and L underscore rid, then it would not be vulnerable to SQL. It would not be vulnerable to PL SQL injection. As it is, this is likely to be if we can manipulate K table. Well, I'm sorry, can it? No, it can't be, because we don't know what table we're going to be selecting from yet. It can't be pre-compiled. So if it was using a bind variable, at least it could be compiled down to the query tree level. At this moment, it can't. Are there any other questions at all? Can I have a show of hands? How many people at some point in their day-to-day job have to work with Oracle, i.e. an Oracle database server? Two. Microsoft SQL Server? DB2? IBM's DB2? Anybody? No one? MySQL? Any other database server? Postgres? Oh, Postgres has got quite an interesting show of hands. All right. Interbase. You use that as well, yeah? Firebird, anybody? Nope. Sybase? Okay. Ah, here's a better question. Who has to work with databases at all? Microsoft Access, even. Okay. So there are no more questions. Doesn't even have to be about PL SQL injection, let's say. Sure, sir? No, there is, in Oracle, the passwords are hashed. Essentially, because the method is known, we can brute force it. We can take a guess, essentially. As long as we have the username that's associated with the hash, then we can attempt to guess it. I'm not sure if I'm understanding the question. In that example, I pre-generated what the password would be if I set the password for the anonymous account to the text anonymous. That's the resulting hash, basically. So by default, the anonymous password is actually set, the hash is set to anonymous, you know, not, therefore you can't log in, basically, with the anonymous account. If, however, we give it a proper password hash, then of course we can log in. So by setting, in that example there, I set, you know, the password to the hash of anonymous for the anonymous account. That way I can then log on as anonymous. It's something to be aware of, that people will use this as a method for backdooring Oracle. Because everyone thinks, well, anonymous is not, you can't log in with it by default, so we don't need to worry about the anonymous account anymore. So people actually do enable the anonymous account. Is that? Thanks. I went through that pretty quickly, didn't I? Let's think. I'm just trying to think if I've got another two for the price of one, you know? No, not really. Okay, let's have a show of hands. Who thinks currently database vendors are doing a good job of delivering secure, robust software? Who thinks they're doing a good job currently? Who thinks they're doing a bad job? Okay. What do you think is the best way to put pressure on the vendors to start making them produce a more secure, more robust product? Public embarrassment? You know, ideas, suggestions? Just throwing it out there. No ideas. Okay. See, I don't want to show demonstrations because obviously that's going to put people at risk. But that takes up, obviously, half the time of the talk, which is why we've gone through it so quickly. Riley, do you have any questions, mate? Sure. Sure. Okay. Essentially, it's using time delays as a mechanism for extracting data through SQL injection. Now, talk about ASP applications and in a Microsoft SQL environment, although this can be done with any kind of technology, essentially. So if I can inject via an ASP form or query string, if I can inject into a query and modify that query such that the given first character of the first row of a selected statement from a table is A, the letter A, then pause 5 seconds. If not, don't pause and just return immediately. Using the wait for delay syntax, then if the response takes 5 seconds to come back, then I know the first letter of the first row of selected data is actually an A. If the query returns immediately, it's not an A, so I then try B, then try C and D, until such time that it waits for 5 seconds. Now, this can be extended further. We can do it on a bit-by-bit basis. So we can say, is the first bit of the first byte of the first row of data returned from the selector or whatever, 1 or 0? If it's 1, wait 5 seconds. If it's 0, return immediately. So we can ascertain whether that bit is 1 or 0. We can then go through each bit doing the same thing. And in a relatively short period of time, we can actually drill down to get complete data from the database server. Now, this is extremely useful in those situations whereby we don't have any information printed back to the screen for us. So if we imagine a logon page where, you know, the query is select star from users table where username equals user input and password is user input. Obviously, we can bypass that login page with a single quote or 1=1-minus kind of attack. Sure, that logs us onto the application. But what happens if we wanted to actually use that instance of SQL injection to drill down for data? Well, we can by using time delays, as the gentleman brings up. By basically querying data bit by bit and using time delays, we can do so. Chris Anley from NGS Software, with one of my colleagues, wrote an excellent paper on using time delays in SQL injection. I think the paper is entitled More Advanced SQL Injection, because he already wrote a paper on advanced SQL injection. If you read More Advanced SQL Injection, it's available on the NGS Software website under the white paper section. It's got a lot of good coverage on this aspect. Another way of doing this, incidentally, is not using time delays. Often, if a procedure, if a page is vulnerable to SQL injection, and we leave, just put a single quote in, we'll invariably get a 500 internal server error from the web server, because there's an unclosed quotation mark kind of problem. So we get a 500 response. By using specific logic inside the injected query, if the data, you know, if the bit is positive, a one rather, finish the query nicely. If it's a 0, don't finish the query nicely and generate a 500 internal server error. So using the difference between a 200 and a 500 response from the web server, we can determine whether the bit we're interested in at that particular time of the query is a 1 or a 0. Now, that's much quicker than using time delays, of course, simply because every time we get, you know, our guess right, then we have to wait for 5 seconds, you know. But using 200 or 500 responses, it can be done very, very quickly. So you can actually extract all the data from the database server in a relatively short period of time. Needless to say, if the database server is, 50 gigabytes big, then you're going to have to, like, add a few more hours or so. A few more days, I would imagine. Perhaps even years. Who knows? But the technique is definitely there and is well documented in Chris Anley's paper. Cool. Any other questions? Riley, I see you're quite close to the mic there, mate. If we can influence anywhere, Let me think of a somewhat contrived example. Assume we have a batch job. We have two database servers, one over here and one over here. And this one is considered the front-end back-end, and this one's the back-end back-end. And periodically, this polls this one for updated information. And then performs actions based upon this data. On the way in to this system, it might not be vulnerable to SQL injection. So it's not vulnerable to first order SQL injection. But by specifying the data in a certain way, we might have second order SQL injection. For example, if we have a back-end database server over here that basically withdraws data from here and performs some operation based upon that data, then we have the chance for second-order SQL injection. And, of course, the extension goes on, you know, tertiary and so on, quaternary and so on. It gets highly, highly complicated, though, and I would suggest that if it's using a custom solution, i.e. a homegrown solution, then you're going to have to be really lucky to work it out, because there's no direct interaction to work out whether you're being successful or not. If you're using an off-the-shelf solution, then obviously once you get an attacker gets the off-the-shelf solution and plays around with it and hacks it around and works out how to do it, then of course you can be compromised. So I've not actually done any specific research in this area, but without having to do any specific research in this area, you can see that it's going to be vulnerable just in a different fashion. Thanks. How are we doing for time, by the way? Still have half an hour. Sorry? Okay. Sure. Okay. Well, I was going to say it's a fool's game. They don't work. For every conceivable way you could think of someone injecting into one of your queries, there are three more ways you can't think of. One of the more amusing or ironic protection mechanisms is to if a keyword is discovered in some user data, remove that. You make it safe. So we had a customer, actually, who had come up with their homegrown solution for, a signature, basically. So if the word select appeared inside user data, they would extract the word select and, squash it up and push it on forward, thinking it was then safe. So what we did to bypass that was basically say, sell, select, ect. So what happened was when they extracted the select and squashed it up again, it became select and it got through, If someone can inject SQL, it's game over. Especially when you consider programmable SQL with TSQL, for example, we can specify strings in hexadecimal. So I could go 0x, 41, whatever kind of thing, and execute that. I can also do that with Unicode. I can also embed that within a function that will do another thing to it. I could go tr bracket foo kind of thing, I could hide my brackets. There are thousands and thousands, almost an infinite number of ways of encoding data if it's programmable. And with TSQL, PLSQL, PGSQL, and everything like this, it's programmable. So for every way you can think of coming up with a signature, a defense, you know, something you could say, if we put this into our ASP application and validate it against this blacklist, there are thousands of other ways of bypassing that. So whitelists are probably the best way to go. Excuse me. So rather than looking for, you know, bad words like select, you know, exec, call, load, create, or whatever kind of thing, blacklisting, rather than going down that road, whitelist it, but be very, very stringent. You know, be very, very tight with what you're supposed to be doing. For example, if it's a username, like, my name is David Litchfield, okay? I can think of no one who has a bracket in their, unless it's a hacker's handle or something, I can think of no one who has a bracket in their name. So if it's not ASCII 0x41 to ASCII, what was it, would it be, 6A? No, 5A is that, I think. And 0x61 to 7A, with the exception of a minus, because people do have hyphenated names and so on, that's probably the best way to go, is whitelist it, basically, as opposed to blacklisting it. I think there was a company from India. I think his name was Mahoney, wrote a paper on using snort signatures for PLSQL, and it was not long in following that another company, I think it was perhaps SPI Dynamics or someone, wrote another paper saying how flawed the concept was. Whilst everyone was thinking it and thinking of their own examples, you know, it's not nice to diss someone else's work. But since it's already been dissed by someone else, then, you know, I'll refer to it. So, yeah, it's a fool's game. Thinking that you can come up with signatures for these kind of attacks. I mean, you can defeat the attacker who doesn't really know what they're doing, doesn't know that there are defenses in place, and will get caught with the simple things like select. But if we encode our data, then, you know, as an attacker, if we assume that someone has got some kind of defensive mechanism and they're going to be looking for things like select or exec or whatever, and I encode my data in a way that I decide there and then on the spot. Previous times I did this, I chose another method. You know, one of these infinite ways of doing it, chances are the attack's going to get through. So, is that okay? Cool. So, rather than prolonging this any further, you guys all get an extended coffee break. So thank you very much for coming, and I hope I didn't bore you too much. Thank you.